don't know what has got into you lately. And frankly, right now, I don't care. But I will tell you this. While you wear that uniform, you will obey every order you are given. And you will conform to Starfleet regulations and rules of conduct. Is that clear?
Yes, sir, it is. But I won't be wearing this uniform any longer. I'm resigning from the Academy.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, job hopping like he's Julian Bashir's father.
And we're here this week to answer, I guess, is it a question or is it a statement? No, we are not Starfleet.
I think we want to uncover this obsession that the Star Trek franchise has with Starfleet, and we'll do that through the lens of the characters that aren't really Starfleet members. It's interesting, Cam, because I think that the franchise has always framed Starfleet as the be-all, end-all, but we know that there is a much broader view of this universe. It does, like, what, do you think Starfleet members encompass 0.00001% of, like, the UFP population? Like, that's why it's interesting that there's this obsession with it, but I really want to dig into what it actually means for the lives of people that aren't actually members of Starfleet.
Yeah, it's a fun topic, I think. And, you know, if you're looking at a movie, for example, set within a specific job field, it makes entire sense why the majority of the characters fall into that category. You know, if you're watching a war movie, of course, they're mostly all going to be soldiers, for example. But in Star Trek, it's really interesting because so many of our heroes belong in Starfleet. But because it's an ongoing show with hundreds of hours of entertainment, we start to ask ourselves more the question of, well, what's going on around, you know, outside of these, you know, title characters?
I think maybe the easiest way for us to, you know, pick this apart is let's examine it, like, series by series, and we can draw upon the characters. And why don't we talk about what's motivating them? Because beyond the Starfleet calling, that's what we can ascribe kind of the motivation for the vast majority of our Starfleet characters. But I want to dig into what's motivating these characters that are integral to the show, but it's not because of that, you know, Starfleet mission statement in which that they're serving aboard with all these other crew members.
Mm-hmm. Right. So should we start with the original series then?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that was easy. Cam, jumping over to Star Trek The Next Generation.
It's so true, right? Like, it really bummed me out. There was no real representatives of people outside of Starfleet in the original series. It just kind of, it's too bad.
Well, you know, it's the original show. It makes sense. I get that. But with TNG, the only person that we're introduced to in the main cast who's not a member of Starfleet is Wesley. And they remedy that very quickly by making him acting ensign. And then they even give him kind of the better looking uniform. He eventually goes off to Starfleet Academy and he pursues a career. It's really not until Journey's End where he realizes that, you know, being in Starfleet is not the be-all, end-all for him. And it makes sense for this character. We've talked about it recently, but if this is a boy genius chosen by the Traveler or recognized by the Traveler of having this uncanny ability, why would he want to sit at a console and push buttons all day?
Well, and also the thing about Wesley is I think there's a lot of wanting to follow in his father's footsteps as well as his mother's. You know, they're both very important members in Starfleet, very, you know, really well-recognized characters, or, you know, I mean, recognized figures, I should say. But the thing with Wesley is, you know, as a kid, you don't really have a wide view as to the many directions you could go in your life. And I think he's looking at his parents as examples, you know, shiny examples to follow. And it probably isn't until you get, like, the Traveler coming in and saying, like, hey, there is bigger, more exciting things you could do. Whereas I don't think he would even be able to think of bigger, more exciting things to do when we're getting him in season one.
Well, okay, out of all the main cast members, who do you think would be most comfortable not living life as a career Starfleet officer?
Oh, boy. Out of the TNG crew. Does Miles O'Brien count?
No, he does not.
Yeah, I know. Definitely not Picard. God, that's a maybe Worf? Maybe?
Okay. I mean, we can get into Worf a little bit. Actually, why don't we touch on Worf now? I was going to wait for later, but essentially, he leaves Starfleet at the end of Deep Space Nine. He joins the Diplomatic Corps. He is, you know, the ambassador, the Federation ambassador to Kronos. And with absolutely no explanation, by the time we get to Nemesis, he's back in Starfleet, right? So yeah. That tells me he's in fact uncomfortable not being in Starfleet.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Although I feel like a lot of that was just the movies trying to find a way to get him back into the fold where the character journey seemed to be leading in a different direction.
But we still have to, but that's, it's dumb, but we still kind of have to take it as canon, of course. You know? And so that's kind of the disappointing factor where, like, his character journey on the show, I thought was far more interesting than what the 7 minutes of screen time that he ended up with in Nemesis.
True. Although, to be fair, Wesley winds up in a Starfleet uniform in Nemesis as well.
I know. Oh, Nemesis. you keep crapping on our points here.
Yeah.
What about Deanna Troi?
Deanna Troi?
Does she need to be a Starfleet officer to, you know, provide guidance and counseling to people? Like we saw in Star Trek Picard in the episode Nepenthe, that she was able to do just that to Soji, and she's retired from Starfleet at this point. Troi, that is.
I would love to have a little bit of origin material just on what made Deanna Troi join Starfleet and, you know, take the career direction she took. Because I actually think that would probably be a more interesting story than a lot of them. Like, if you tell me Geordi wanted to join Starfleet to work on their engines, I'm like, yeah, I buy that. All I need is one sentence. You know, that guy is a tech, you know, nut. So that makes sense. But like with Deanna, I would like to know how she wound up in Starfleet.
Well, if we fanfic it a little bit, fanfic is, when you turn that into a verb, it doesn't quite roll off the tongue the way I thought it would. But I just wonder if she was a counselor by trade and then decided that she'd have so many more opportunities to apply her skills across different species and cultures if she joined Starfleet. We know it's interesting because I was just watching an episode of Deep Space Nine, Armageddon Game. And Bashir was talking about how he was attending Starfleet Medical Academy. So he makes it sound as if it's an entirely separate academy or a separate campus, at least, from, you know, the San Francisco site. So I wonder if there's like a counseling academy or something, or if it's somewhere where, look, maybe Bashir, he already graduated medical school. Does he really need to go do another 4 years of academy training? Maybe it's only like a 1 year program. And maybe Troi had another similar thing. Maybe she just jumped in for 1 year training program.
You would probably have to take some sort of more advanced course for the type of counseling she would be doing, right? When you're dealing with like long-term space travel and all that, that's not something you would probably be learning or would be required to know for a more, you know, Earth-based job.
Yeah, I can totally buy that. I'll just touch on this. Guinan, you know, she's not quite a main cast member, but she's the closest that we... I think she appeared in the next most number of episodes after O'Brien amongst recurring characters. What motivates Guinan and her journey to be around all these Starfleet officers, yet not don a uniform in combat?
I feel like Guinan has that sort of distance from us mere mortals, you know, the mortals of TNG, if you will, your Rikers, your Troys, your Datas. There's something about this character that sort of wants to be around these other characters and observe them, and she has a real sense of humor about them and kind of to study them and have experiences. But I don't think she wants to do the day-to-day operations of Starfleet. I don't think that's her thing. She's an observer, not someone who's going to sit behind a console or, you know, fix a warp core engine.
I very much get the sense that for Guinan, you know, 6 years on the Enterprise D, it was more like kind of a, you know, when you graduate university and you go wash dishes in Europe while you backpack and just try to make money for like 6 months. It almost felt like this was a bit of a sojourn for her, and mostly just so she could listen to people, listen, be around like her best bud Picard. But she does have this kind of a aloofness to her. Maybe it was a bit of an unfair question to ask you what motivates her, since I really think it is tough to pinpoint what exactly it is that motivates Guinan any given episode or scene.
Right. And I mean, she's a character that, as you say, is tough to pin down. But also, the service to Starfleet that we see of her in the TNG episodes and movies, that is just like a brief flicker of her life. Like, her life is quite long. So, I mean, how big a factor is this journey on the Enterprise really in the scheme of things?
It's like if her, if she lives for 1,000 years, that'd be like our equivalent of, you know, our over the course of our 60-year lifespan or 80-year lifespan, it'd be like us deciding we were going to go spend a weekend volunteering, cleaning the beach up or something like that, you know, out of our entire life, right?
Yeah, yeah. And now let's just say for the, just for a fun little thought experiment, say Guinan, after her, whatever, 6 or 7 years, was like, you know what? Starfleet is where it is. What kind of job do you think she would take on?
That is a very good question. I could buy her a ship's counselor. She often did kind of tread on what Troy's job was. But beyond the ship's counselor position, I wonder, I can almost picture her at the con, like being kind of the guiding hand of the ship, so to speak, metaphorically and literally.
Yeah, I could see that. That's actually a pretty good call.
Any ideas? What would you think?
Well, you know, the counselor one does make a lot of sense just because she's so worldly and has just such a deep understanding of how people are thinking and feeling. I mean, we see that in so many episodes. I think that would really be her, like a really, you know, automatic specialty, I think, for her. She has such amazing people skills. I would want to put her in a job that utilizes those. I don't know, like, if I would say if she would want to be a captain or, a first officer, but she has those types of managerial skills where I think she would be very strong at that sort of role.
Well, let me pose this. What about Chief of Security? She has to talk people down quite a lot, use diplomacy rather than escalate it towards, you know, physical violence. And we also know that she's pretty good with a phaser rifle when push comes to shove.
Yeah, time zero. I mean, she would actually be a really interesting security chief, kind of like Odo in some ways, who I'm sure we'll talk about in a few minutes. But, you know, you don't see Odo getting in fistfights, right? Like, I think a lot of times when people hear security, they're thinking of Worf charging into a, you know, a combat situation and quickly getting his butt kicked. But, you know, you can see that you can have someone like an Odo or a Tuvok also is another good example. Someone who's very calm, thoughtful, but has the understanding of, you know, the personalities and just the, you know, humanity or what have you, the alien types that would be necessary to fulfill that job. And I think that would be a really good avenue for Guinan to explore. I kind of like that.
Well, you brought it up, Deep Space Nine. Let's jump over there. And there's a character in particular that it's actually a very important moment in Deep Space Nine's run. And actually, it really informs my understanding of Star Trek. And this is actually from the Deep Space Nine Season 2 episode, Shadow Play. It's mostly forgettable, except for one major point, which it establishes that Jake Sisko doesn't really want to join Starfleet. He's tagging along with O'Brien, poking at Isolinear rods, and it's really just out of obligation to his father rather than any sort of passion. And at that time, I just assumed that he'd be destined to go off to the Academy by the end of the series or something like that. And I was miffed at first when he revealed that he didn't want to join Starfleet. I was like, why wouldn't he? What else is he going to do? The franchise makes it very clear that everybody should join Starfleet. But it makes so much sense for Jake. It develops a character and offers some new, like, nuance in a way we weren't expecting. Also think about his own personal history, where his mother's dead because of his own father's career in Starfleet. And honestly, this career path for Jake, it saves him from kind of that same trajectory that maybe Wesley could have gone on in the way that viewers interpret him, where he's kind of the try hard at all times and he gets kind of annoying. I would never describe Jake Sisko as an annoying character. He's maybe a bit more in the background, but I'd never call him annoying at all.
No, I wouldn't say that either. I think a lot of kid characters can be very cloying on TV. I don't think Jake Sisko falls into that at all. It's actually quite an achievement, especially when you consider child performances in 1990s TV shows. The thing about Jake Sisko, too, that I really like is that he's very much a kid, but also, in contrast to Wesley, okay, let's look at what Wesley's looking at. You know, he's looking at his father, his mother, there on the Enterprise. What an amazing environment for a kid to grow up in. Whereas, let's look at what Jake Sisko's looking at. Sisko doesn't seem to be having the world's greatest time on Deep Space Nine.
Not in the early go of it, for sure.
No, but he's like, obviously he's lost his mother in Battle of Wolf 359. Again, that's a big Starfleet conflict there. And then we go over to Deep Space Nine. There's a lot of torment there. You know, his father's dealing with, this spiritual leader, role he's having to take on. You've got the Dominion War. That's a lot of very heavy stuff for a kid to observe. And I don't think it's the idealized portrait of Starfleet he's taking in that maybe Wesley is looking at his mother and father, or, Picard by extension.
I totally buy that. Well, let me ask you this. What comes of Jake at the end? I picture him staying on Deep Space Nine. To me, that seems like it's his home. It seems like there is a lot of action there. If he, pursues a writing career, he's going to find a lot of inspiration there as well.
Well, and maybe that's the thing with Jake, is that with Jake, he found a home. He didn't find a career. Like, that's two different things, right?
Yeah.
And for Jake to be a writer, I wonder if there's a little bit of a, page taken out of the Joseph Sisko book where, his grandfather is a very happy restaurateur. He loves his job. He loves, creating things for customers. And maybe Jake looks more at his grandfather as an example he wants to follow in terms of a career goal, like doing what you're passionate about. And he's just not passionate about Starfleet.
He's more passionate about scrubbing clams and back alleys.
Exactly. And I mean, there's that episode. Is it Nor the Battle for the Strong, where he goes into
Nor the Battle Be for the Strong, I believe. Or no, nor is it Nor the Battle for the Strong. Anyways, we know what episode we're talking about. Yeah.
Yes. The one where he goes into a combat situation with Bashir. And, we see throughout the Dominion War that Starfleet has to take a part in some very ugly situations and conflicts. And I think we learn very well in that episode. That is not something that Jake Sisko wants to take part in.
When you said he had to go into a combat situation with Bashir, I'm just picturing the two of them in an MMM ring fighting each other.
Okay, who wins that one?
I think it devolves into a slap fight, and then they eventually just have to both call mercy because they're tickling each other too much.
They're both very tall men, so they both have that long reach, so you can't say one has a unfair advantage over the other. But I don't think it's much of a fight, that's for sure. The spectators are walking out disappointed.
Do you think Bashir's sort of genetic enhancements, he gets that kind of like hand-eye coordination, is able to knock him out, not with a powerful punch, but like a well-positioned punch? Could that work?
Possibly. We saw he was actually really amazing at darts, so maybe that lends itself to a fight, although we never got to see Bashir really do anything like that. We saw him very capable, I guess, in the odd fight throughout the show. Like, don't they take on some Jem'Hadar in, is it maybe like One Little Ship or something like that, where Bashir's on the actual Defiant and they take a few of them down?
That rings a bell. I just mentioned Armageddon Game, and he did have to push somebody to the side before Miles O'Brien was able to shoot the guy. So he at least was able to defend himself to a certain degree.
Yeah. So I think I would probably give the edge to Bashir.
Okay. One last thing about Jake though, but I was kind of disappointed that they didn't do more with his efforts to be a journalist during the war. I think that could have offered an interesting avenue to him at that point in his life, beyond kind of the creative writing that he was doing. And we didn't quite get there as often as I would have hoped.
I think they should have done some episodes, maybe you're only going to get one episode a season, but where we kind of follow Jake as like a war correspondent. We got a lot of talk about him writing stories about, the Dominion invasion of DS9 and various things like that. But I would have liked an episode kind of that fly on the wall journalist following a story. I think you could have done a really interesting Dominion War story that's not entirely a portrait of Jake the reporter, but you follow him and see how he's taking it in. I think that could have been a really interesting story.
Do you think he could have had a bestseller on Bajor if he did a biography on his father and called it Emma's Story?
It wouldn't do quite as well as if he'd followed and done the Vedic Barile Chronicles.
Oh, fair enough. Cam, why don't we jump over to Kira? Because there's another very, very pinnacle episode for me here, and it's one that is easily dismissed by others. But Move Along Home in season one of Deep Space Nine.
Why do you always have to bring up Move Along Home?
Well, Kira has this one-off line, and I think it's very telling about what her role is, what's motivating her. But they end up in this living board game, and she's noticing that Jadzia's, you know, all into it with the tricorder. And Kira's like, I'm an administrator, I'm not an explorer. And I think that's very telling. It's like she did not join the Bajoran militia to go seek out new life and new civilizations. She's there to make Bajor better. I think we really do know what motivates her as the kind of this freedom fighter turned career military person. But Cam, do you envision, like, okay, after Sisko departs, she's in charge of the station, but is she kind of this person she's waiting to become General Kira by the end in charge? I just don't know if she's serving in the Bajoran militia for the rest of her life.
No, I could see her assuming some sort of role of prominence in Bajoran society at some point as well. I think the thing with Kira is, and this is something that maybe there's a little bit of privilege going on for, you know, the Earth people, the Vulcans, you know, what have you, the Tellarites, in that, you know, they join the Federation. It's like, it's all about exploring. It's all about going out there and seeing what's out there. You know, risk is our business and what have you. But for someone like Kira, Bajor has a lot of problems. She doesn't have the luxury that maybe these other, you know, Federation members have of just looking outwards at the stars and saying, let's go explore out there. She has a lot of work to do, I think, in her lifetime to get Bajor to a better place. And so that is very much her mission. She's looking back home and the importance of, you know, leading to a positive evolution for her planet. She can't quite look, you know, out to the stars. That's for maybe future generations of Bajorans in a lot of ways.
Well, what do you think, okay, with regards to the What We Left Behind documentary and her role in, you know, kind of the theoretical season eight, do you kind of take that as canon in your own head? I know it's not official, but she really isn't, like, in kind of the same position as she was before, was she?
No. Is it canon in my mind?
She's a Vedic. I should mention, she is a Vedic at this point, you know?
Right, yeah. It's semi-canon? Semi in as much as it's the only official word I've ever heard. You know, it's coming from the people that created the show that are telling me this is where they think Kira might end up. So that's something. That's more of a nugget to me than, like, you know, something like in a comic book or a novel or a, you know, fan film or something like that. Like, I can actually look at this and say, okay, that's where they think the character would, you know, move to. But, I mean, look, Kira was a very spiritual character. We saw that on several episodes of the show. And I think the one thing that makes this sort of interesting to me is that we saw how she clashed with Kai Winn for so long, right? And Kai Winn, someone who took over as spiritual leader to Bajor and did an untold amount of harm. So I wonder how much of Kira's direction in terms of assuming that type of role is like repairing the sins that, you know, Kai Winn had caused and another one could cause in the future.
I can buy that. The other thing that, like, another possibility, though, is at the, you know, final 10 episodes, we saw her briefly commissioned as a Starfleet officer when she was working with the Cardassian Underground. If Bajor joins the Federation, do you see her pursuing a career as a Starfleet officer? Or is that the point where she decides to leave it and, you know, pursue that spiritual journey as a Vedic?
I just don't see her joining Starfleet in any way, shape, or form.
Nor,
like,
do I.
It just doesn't even make sense. And that's actually one of my favorite things about Deep Space Nine, is that when we looked at, you know, the two shows we've already talked about, TOS doesn't really count, but I feel like the only representative we get there of someone who's not Starfleet is really Harry Mudd, which is very sad. But when you look at, like, TNG, there's almost this kind of browbeating of characters about the importance of Starfleet. And what I always love about DS9 is that characters like Kira or Odo, you don't have Bashir or, you know, Sisko or what have you going to them and, you know, pounding into their head over and over, like, you really should be looking at Starfleet. Starfleet's the only future for you. I like that there's that respect in terms of the roles they fill and that there's, you know, untold possibilities in their own career paths away from Starfleet.
Why don't we jump over to her partner in crime at times, no pun intended, but Odo. an episode like Necessary Evil. It establishes why he's chief of security when he's given this task by Gul Dukat back on the Terek Nor days. And it's not out of a sense of, you know, exploration. It's his own sense of justice is why he pursues that. And I think that's very telling about what's driving him, what's motivating him. And it's not for those, you know, Starfleet ideals of exploration or anything.
I think Odo's in some ways more interesting to talk about than Kira, because I think Kira, we have a pretty strong understanding as to why she would not join Starfleet or why it's just not a good idea. With Odo, I completely buy the character not doing that, but you could also see why he might be drawn to it, and that Odo doesn't really belong to anything. At the start of DS9, it's not till later on that we are dealing with the Great Link and all that sort of thing. But he is someone who does feel like an outsider, and Starfleet might give him that sort of acknowledgement and invite him into a larger world he could belong to. So I think there's maybe more of an argument for an Odo taking that path, but I also like that the character has this loner quality that when you watch the show, you completely understand why he doesn't join.
I think he has zero interest in joining Starfleet. Whenever you see him, you know, rub up against other Starfleet security officers, it's always because the Starfleet officers are rigid with their rules, and he is kind of indifferent towards Starfleet regulations. His job is to get behind whatever is causing security issues. And I think he just finds Starfleet's a little bit too, you know, nosy, in your face for his liking.
And also, Odo seems to be more focused on a smaller world. You know, Odo's world is the security department of DS9. He's not really looking outwards, really. And I think that's really interesting in a franchise where characters are always, you know, gazing outwards.
Yeah. Kim, Quark, interesting fellow. I think he's the least likely to ever pursue a career in Starfleet out of the three people that we talked about right before him.
I don't think he'd ever pass the tests.
even if his nephew did, do you think he thinks to himself, hey, if Nog could get in, I bet if I really wanted to, I could get in?
I don't know if his rap sheet would allow him to get into the Starfleet good graces, but putting that aside, I could see that. Like, well, the thing about Quark is he has a real arrogance about him where he would look like kind of roll his eyes about, you know, Nog or Rom. But at the same time, I don't know that he has the commitment to do it. I think a lot of it is just ego driven. I don't think he thinks necessarily logically when it comes to whether he could make Starfleet or not.
Well, let's talk about what motivates Quark. Profit. Is there really much profit to be made in Starfleet?
Not from what I've seen.
Yeah. Well, although I guess the economy never really made sense for them. And they tried to touch on it in Star Trek Picard, and I was still kind of baffled by how anything operates there. But it looks as if, I don't know, it's a bartering system of some sorts.
Yeah, I mean, I could see Quark being quite content with, like, Picard's winery. I could see that, his vineyard. But
and by that, you mean his sniveling that he did in season one of the series, right?
Yes, clearly.
Yeah.
But I don't know that he would be as content with, like, Raffi's very luxurious trailer.
Actually, you know, she complained about that trailer. It seemed like a nice location. It seemed cozy. She's got a patio there. It's not that bad, was it?
I can think of far worse.
Yeah. Kim, Star Trek Voyager here. Okay, this is such a weird one. I think I was looking through the list of characters. I think there's actually like only two true Starfleet members out of the entire cast. We can break it down very quickly before we touch on the characters one by one. But I think that it's really only Harry Kim and Janeway that are the only real Starfleet officers. Do you consider the holographic doctor to be a Starfleet officer?
No, but what about Tuvok? He is.
I'm sorry.
Just undercover.
You know what? Tuvok undercover. Okay, I'll give you that. But Tom got thrown in jail.
Yep.
You know, we had Torres. She dropped out of the academy. Chakotay quit because of the whole Cardassian Maquis conflict. We have Seven of Nine. We have Kes. We have Neelix. There's really only, like, just those three. I think just Tuvok, Kim, and Janeway. I that's the lowest number, I think, out of all the series to date.
It is. And I think it is a feather in the cap of DS9 in that you very much understand the differences in the characters, that those who are with Starfleet, those who aren't, versus Voyager, where a good section of the characters, like your Neelix or your Cass or Tom Paris, it ain't long before they're like, aye, aye, Captain, we're on the Starfleet, ship here. It's kind of a missed opportunity.
Literally, the only character that I believe never donned a Starfleet uniform was Kes. Remember, Neelix did it when he joined security, I believe, in Year of Hell? And then Seven of Nine, there was that time travel episode, I'm blanking on the name, where she was essentially pretending to be a crew member from, much earlier, like 3 years before she even joined the crew or anything like that. Does that ring a bell to you? I think she's wearing a blue uniform.
Yeah, that rings a bell.
Yeah, so, let's break down what's motivating these characters. Neelix, I think he's just looking for a new gig. I think this guy's run out of time in his little corner of the Delta Quadrant. He sees this opportunity and he jumps on it with Voyager. I don't ever really see this guy earnestly pursuing a career in Starfleet.
Well, Neelix, though, is a little bit of the anti-Odo, where you throw Odo onto the ship, he's spending a lot of time in his room, whereas Neelix is like, this is fun time. I'm going to hang out with these people. I'm going to talk my way into all their briefings. Like, this guy really embraces the idea of being on a Starfleet ship.
I can't believe how bitter some of the junior crew members must be that they are never invited to those briefings where he seems to be in, at least 2/3 of them?
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, the morale officer apparently is very important. So important that this role was probably not filled before Neelix showed up.
Well, maybe he perished or she perished in that caretaker incident. Who knows? What about Kes? This is a tough one because she's essentially like a 1 or 2 year old who's scooped off her home planet. But she does have that sense of exploration. Like, she was the one who was finding, holes in the caverns to escape up to that surface. Like, that exploratory trait is innate within her, yet I don't see her as a Starfleet officer.
I think she could be one, though. Yeah? I think with this character, I mean, the reason that, they throw some barriers down in terms of her becoming one. Obviously the whole psychic powers that she doesn't understand, a little bit of the Jean Grey and the X-Men kind of syndrome going on there. They kind of keep her a little off balance. And then she's written out, obviously, at the end of season 3. But when I see her behavior with the doctor as, assistant in the med bay, the way she deals with the other crew members, I buy her as someone that maybe over time, if she had a longer lifespan, would be more tempted to become a member of Starfleet. Like, Neelix, what is Neelix going to do, really? I mean, I feel like this is, he really was, fell into an advantageous situation of the Voyager ship needing a morale officer because they were down. Whereas I feel like Kes would blend in much better in a more routine Starfleet situation.
I keep thinking about that scene in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, where Valeris fires that phaser in the kitchen and dissolves the pot to reveal mashed potatoes inside. And then I realize there are literal cooks on these ships. Do you think those cooks just don't exist, 100 years in the future when Neelix could have joined Starfleet?
Yeah, because you've got, Chef in Enterprise, but...
I don't think Chef was ever, a commissioned Starfleet officer, though.
Probably not.
They never called him Ensign Chef.
We'll do a whole other episode on the chefs of Star Trek some point down the road. But, Yeah, I don't know. That's a really tough one.
I don't see him ever joining Starfleet.
No, I don't know. Like, what would he do? Because the thing is, yeah, you're right. When you look at TNG and, DS9 and what have you, you don't have, chefs or anything or cooks that are Starfleet members. And I mean, in the original series, they're eating cubes of, colored cubes. So I don't think it takes a chef to prepare those. Do you think there is that episode you said as, Neelix helps with security? Would Neelix ever pursue a security role, though?
No,
say when they landed back at Earth? It makes no sense.
You're giving him way too much credit. He's not going to be a Starfleet officer ever.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to do the thought experiment more so as to what would make sense for him.
Okay, well, again, I go to the con. I think he could be, he's piloted his own ship. He can navigate, you know, as a guide to a certain degree without a map, you know. I get that. So maybe I would put him, not in security, but more, you know, piloting shuttles, even though we didn't get to see him do it that much.
Yeah, I think it's just very fortuitous for Starfleet that there was a Talaxian colony on the way home.
Very fortuitous, yes. Well, Chakotay, okay, this is, okay, the Chakotay-Torres thing is so weird, because they're Maquis members, but they must don Starfleet uniforms. This, like, but they don't want to be careerists in Starfleet, yet, remember when Chakotay and B'Elanna find out that the Dominion wiped out all the Maquis, and do you think that maybe makes Chakotay realize, well, my cause is lost, should I just return to Starfleet and pursue that?
Tyler, there is a fire to the Chakotay character that is so missing that would answer this question. But what we actually see on screen is the most docile character, not really responding to things in a way that we can really glean any sort of psychological insight from. That's the problem. Like, I would love to have insight into this character or B'Elanna in terms of going, you know, to the Maquis and then coming back to Starfleet and struggling with that. But the show just never... it never deals with it in a way that feels really profound. It's really frustrating.
Based on what we were shown and what we do know of them, I don't see either one of them jumping on board another starship. I see Tom, who also was kind of pushed out of Starfleet with after getting caught on his first Maquis mission. I don't see him returning to Starfleet either. I see him and B'Elanna settling down at her working maybe on like a freighter or something like that while he writes holo novels. And with Chakotay, I'm guessing he goes on more of a spiritual journey after Seven dumps his ass.
Well, I hope his journey in reality is better than the alternate future.
Yes, short-lived.
But I will say about Tom Paris. Chakotay, I'm kind of intrigued by the fact that the show left it a question mark. I mean, the fact is he's dead in the alternate future, so there's nothing to even look at and say, well, that makes sense for that character to go in that direction. Like, we can't get anything, so... and that whole final episode is really about his romance with Seven, so you don't have a good sense. I could see him. The spiritual journey makes sense. It's the best of what really the show has to offer. The Tom Paris one, honestly, when they present that he runs the Voyager Museum, makes sense to me.
Yeah, I buy that. Seven of Nine, we already know the answer. She eventually becomes a Fenris Ranger, but this is after Icheb has been mentored by her and he joins Starfleet. Did you ever picture her at least considering a career as a Starfleet officer?
Sort of. And that's largely because she was someone who regained so much of her humanity through the Voyager crew and the experiences of working with Starfleet people that I could see that maybe when she gets back, she's tempted to pursue that. But on the flip side, I can also understand how she gets back and she's got bigger priorities to the direction of her life than dedicating it to Starfleet. She needs to understand what her life is, period, without Starfleet even being a factor in that.
It's been almost 20 years. Do you see, hypothetically, if she was to join Starfleet, would she be like a lieutenant commander by now? Would she be kind of the a stellar cartographer still, or would she be pursuing some other avenue possible?
Stellar cartography seems too limited at a certain point. But here's the thing, too, about Seven is she didn't necessarily fall too well into the kind of the regimented behavior of Starfleet. Like, a lot of the conflict on Voyager was her kind of bumping up against Janeway. Does that lend itself well when she gets back? And let's just say she pursues a Starfleet career. You know, she's not winding up with, say, Janeway as her captain necessarily. Like, does Seven make sense in a Starfleet organization even?
I wonder if she even makes it through the Academy.
Yeah.
So, look, I'm actually... okay, so I was pleased when we saw Picard that she... I think it could have been just such a cliche, easy thing for her to be revealed again and we find out she is a Starfleet officer. I think this opens up more avenues for her character exploration in Season 2 of Star Trek Picard. I hope they do something interesting with her. But as for what's motivating her, throughout Voyager's run, those four seasons, I think it is this deep sense that she does want to become more human. That there is more of an internal exploration going on rather than that external exploration that the Starfleet officers are pursuing.
And I just don't think you can figure out your career if you don't know who you are. And I think that's a key part of it. So I appreciate that the show doesn't, really point that in as a hard direction for her future. I remember being a little frustrated with Picard when it's like, I'm a Fenris Ranger and what have you. But the more I think about that character's journey and whether Starfleet makes sense, I'm actually, I don't know that I really even understand what a Fenris Ranger is yet, but I'm okay with her going an unconventional route in terms of Star Trek characters. I think that's actually maybe more fitting for that character.
Didn't we think for like an episode that they were just pronouncing Federation when they kept saying Fenris? Or like it was like an abbreviation? Like I kept thinking like she's a Federation Ranger.
Well, they just kept throwing the word Fenris at you like you should know what it means.
Yeah. Like, it didn't work on me. That went over my head there.
Yeah, I still don't understand what they are. And no. I'm not expecting a Fenris Ranger deep dive in the future either.
I did look it up on Memory Alpha once, and I think it's like a two-sentence entry because I don't even think that they're sure what it is.
Weren't they just kind of like, I don't know if vigilante is the word, or just kind of like almost like Wild West outlaw, or not outlaws, Wild West sort of sheriffs?
Kind of
particular section of town. Yeah,
kind of trying to bring some order to things there. Very briefly, yeah. The doctor, look, he's a hologram. He never went to the academy. He doesn't have any pips. I don't consider the doctor to be a Starfleet officer, despite the fact that his projection includes a uniform. And look, we see that he literally quits being the doctor on the ship so he could be an opera singer in one of the worst episodes of Star Trek Voyager. What motivates the doctor to you, Cam?
Tyler, I think you made a mistake there. I think you meant best, but
my apologies. Yes, I live for the opera, virtuoso.
We could all relate to that one.
Yeah,
Tyler's dressed like Pagliacci the clown right now.
Yeah, but the version from Seinfeld when it was Crazy Joe.
But yeah, the doctor is someone who, as a Starfleet program, however you want to define him, as soon as he had that mobile emitter and began to expand his worldview, I think the idea of being with Starfleet just became smaller and smaller. As you said, you know, he fell in love with opera, photography, storytelling, all these, you know, other pursuits. When we see him show up in that Voyager finale, he just seems like he's just like living the life of kind of a Renaissance man, if you will. He's not a guy who wants to sit behind a console or even just be a doctor on a ship.
No, I for sure. Like it's a feature, not a bug in his programming, but it seems as if he was meant for more than, suturing wounds with laser utensils or something.
Yeah, he's kind of the anti-Data, because Data would learn about theater and painting and all these sort of artistic pursuits. But at the core, Data very much believed in being a Starfleet officer and perhaps becoming a first officer or a captain at some point. That's not something you get from the Doctor. He discovers humanity and goes, man, there's a lot to explore in humanity. The heck with this Starfleet stuff.
Yeah, no, and I think that is an interesting worldview for the Star Trek franchise, in which we're always told that Starfleet is the be-all, end-all.
The whole concept of Star Trek is humanism, as, you know, preached by Gene Roddenberry. And there's a lot of wonders to what, you know, humans can achieve that is a grand pursuit on its own without sitting behind a console and exploring various planets.
Now, if we go back to a time where Starfleet was not the be-all, end-all, we have T'Pol as the science officer aboard the NX-01. I think she looks down upon Starfleet, but by the time we get, to season 3, she's a commissioned officer, or she's seconded to the point where she is wearing, like, an arm patch, but she is not wearing the uniform. I never really understood that.
Yeah, well, yeah. 2000s television.
Okay,
<Tyler.
laughs> okay. But I do think that she is motivated by similar things that motivate Starfleet officers, though, is that sense of curiosity and exploration. She is a science officer, and even though she is more of the skeptic, more so than other scientists that we encounter in Star Trek, she is diligent in her pursuits of the unknown.
And the thing about T'Pol is, I said with Kira, for example, that I really liked that this character never felt like they were going to join Starfleet, and other characters never really, you know, imposed that on them or what have you. With T'Pol, it's a different story in that we know the Vulcans are so fundamental to what Starfleet will be going forward that someone has to kind of take that first step. And I think it's really interesting that it is T'Pol, and we get, you know, two seasons of her not being a member. And it isn't until she kind of understands what Starfleet could be or maybe where it's going that there's some interest. You know, Vulcans are very intellectual, and I think it raises that intellectual interest. So I actually buy her commitment because it feels character-driven as opposed to the show just being like, look, we have to have a Vulcan in Starfleet.
Well, if we have to have a Vulcan in Starfleet, we never did have to have a Denobulan. Phlox never joined Starfleet. I can't imagine his academy regime myself, but I keep wondering, like, what motivates Phlox beyond that first episode in which he's literally the only one on planet Earth that has any familiarity with Klingon physiology. Why does he stick around with his crew, Cam?
Is he like a Guinan who's just like kind of amused by everything and very curious? I mean, I feel like for him, this is kind of like a free ticket to go to various planets and collect bugs.
I almost think he's just curious about being around these humans in this confined space, which is unlike his experience on Earth. He seemed to enjoy his time on Earth, though, much like Saval, like he enjoys or is fond of humans to a certain degree. He keeps bringing up that Chinese restaurant that he loves to visit and occasionally get beaten up outside of.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, he just seems, the thing about that character is he just seems so bemused by everything. I think it's just maybe intellectual curiosity for him. And, you know, it's like you said with Saval. And I think, you know, other, obviously, Sarek as well. There's something about humans that some of these aliens just find kind of fascinating. And I think maybe that's the case with Phlox, but I don't see him wanting to go through Starfleet Academy. Like, that just doesn't make sense. But as a doctor, he gets to have the experience without having to go through, you know, having to escape from a burning room.
Well, look, if Admiral Forrest went up to him and said, look, if you want to continue serving on this ship, you need to go through, I don't know, a year of Starfleet training, I could picture him just saying, oh, well, this is a fun journey. I'm going to go back to Denobulus, find more medical opportunities there. Like, I don't see him feeling this compulsion to stick around on the NX-01.
I don't spend a lot of time wanting a postscript on the cast of characters on Enterprise. Like, I have a pretty good understanding in my mind as to where these characters would probably go. Phlox is the one I do wonder about, though.
I feel as if he is kind of like more of a quieter life ahead than, say, Seven of Nine. Just taking other characters out of the franchise, for example, though. I see him retiring with his husbands and wives and the many children and just having a chill time.
Is he kind of like Bilbo Baggins? He goes out on the adventure and he just goes home.
Hopefully Bilbo rather than Frodo, right?
I think so. I don't think you necessarily want to be Frodo. And Phlox, as tormented as he was during the Zindi War arc, I don't think he was quite as tormented as Frodo.
It's weird that he kept like sitting like Gollum in all the meetings, though.
Okay, if he is the Frodo, who's the Gollum?
The Gollum of the ship?
Sure.
Or the series? Is it, I guess I'm going with the space Nazi.
Okay, perfect, good choice.
Just because of the look.
Yeah.
So there you go. Is Archer Aragorn? He has to be, right?
Aragorn has a little bit of danger to him. I guess so. Like, I don't think there's another choice. I think he has to be the Aragorn. I was like trying to think of someone who was maybe a little less by the book. But I don't know that there's a good candidate. Plus, I think Scott Bakula would look amazing with, like, sweeping long hair flapping in the breeze.
Is Mayweather the Boromir, you know, the Sean Bean of the crew, in which he's there for a little bit?
Yeah, probably. Okay. Although people constantly talk about Boromir as the films keep going in the books, whereas maybe characters aren't talking about Mayweather later down the road that much.
Is he more like Tom Bombadil?
Yes! He's the Tom Bombadil!
In which he doesn't even make it into the movies.
Travis Bombadil.
Travis Bombadil. Okay, I like it. Okay, well, I don't think we'll top that, so I've got a question I wanted to pose to you, Cam. If Shran, he was supposed to join the main cast in season 5, at least that's what Manny Cota, the showrunner, had promised Jeffrey Combs, would Shran have been in Starfleet, or would he have been seconded from the Andorian Imperial Force?
I think I like the idea more of him being kind of like T'Pol in the first couple seasons, where he's an Andorian representative on the ship. Shran's methods and behavior don't really lend themselves to even an early version of Starfleet. I would prefer to have a little more of that friction that we got on, you know, DS9 or with the Seven Janeway relationship, where you have Shran on the ship serving in a formal capacity, but maybe butting heads with Archer a bit. I think that's way more interesting.
I'm just picturing how he was literally torturing Saval in like the previous season. Now I'm going to join Starfleet.
Let's just say that show goes 7 seasons, okay? And we get the, like, heartwarming final ending of the series, a la What We Left Behind, or What We Leave Behind, or What You Leave Behind. The title I'm always going to mix up thanks to that documentary. Nonetheless,
what we,
final episode.
What We Leave Behind. Or no, yes. What... No, no, or... What You Leave Behind. What You Leave Behind.
Yes.
Now you've DS9. Screwed me up on this, Cam. You've messed it up so many times that I'm now screwing it up.
I apologize, but you remember that moment in that where we get the flashback to all the amazing moments they've had on the ship? Imagine a Shran one, and then we get black and white clips of him torturing Saval.
That would be amazing. And then guess what? The camera in color pans to Travis Mayweather, and when it fades to black and white, it's just pictures of the empty corridor.
Or just his footage missing.
Yeah. Oh, that poor guy. Anthony Montgomery's great. We're not dissing Anthony Montgomery. Like, when he was given stuff to do on that show, he was great. It's just that they didn't give him much to do on that show.
Anyone who listens to this show knows we're fans of Anthony Montgomery. That guy's got a huge amount of charisma and personality. But Travis Mayweather, it's one of those weird cases where so often they wrote to the actor at a certain point, and you get characters that really pop throughout the series. Whereas, like, with Mayweather, they never did that, and I don't know why.
They got lazy. Yeah. Well, Kim, let's jump over to Star Trek Discovery. It's kind of an interesting mix. Let's kick off with season 1. You have Ash Tyler, who's in fact Volk, who I guess is with, you know, the Klingon Defense Forces, or, you know, at least with T'Kuvma's, you know, branch there. But he doesn't know that he's not in Starfleet. He absolutely 100% believes that he is. It's no surprise to me that he does feel a little lost by the end of season 1.
Yeah, I mean, him just kind of being this sort of drifter in season 2 is more interesting, because I don't think, it kind of goes back to if you don't know yourself, you don't know what you want to set your sights on. And so it makes sense to me that Ash Tyler, it isn't until the end of season 2 that we get this more formal role within Section 31, because even throughout season 2 when he's serving as a Section 31 liaison, it doesn't feel like it's the most well-thought-out job.
No, not at all. What about, speaking of Section 31 operative, look, we have Giorgio. She lands in this side of the Mirror Universe. She doesn't really have anything to do. I think the secret scene that didn't air with the episode, but it revealed that Leland recruited her when she was, like, working as a barmaid, like, on Kronos or something? Does that ring a bell?
I thought she was just hanging out there because that was, like, her place to be.
Okay. She wasn't like Carla from Cheers?
I think she was more of like the Norm there in that or Orion hangout.
Okay, okay. I prefer to think of her as more of the Lilith.
Fair enough.
You know, got the BB New Earth Star Trek connection as well. But look, I can buy her being recruited, you know, for Section 31. What motivates her other than just taking pleasure and causing pain?
I would say the only thing that motivates her is an attachment to Michael Burnham. I think that is it. Because can you have someone aiding a Starfleet mission when they do not agree or care about anything to do with Starfleet?
Why would you recruit this person?
It really does. I mean, look, it's a conceit of the show to get an interesting character on there. So I'm in favor of it because Michelle Yeoh is so much fun on the show. But it really makes almost no sense. It's the sort of thing, if you saw this happen, say on TNG, it would be a one-off episode. It would not be an entire season.
But Cam, we've got this Section 31 spinoff coming, right?
Yeah.
So she's going to keep pursuing this career in Section 31 without that attachment to Michael Burnham?
And I would also like to note that is a show or a project that they have promised will have the optimism of Star Trek, which is a very weird thing to attach optimism in the character of Georgiou.
I don't know how they accomplish this because I don't know what motivates her. And if you don't know what motivates your main character, you're going to have a very, very frustrating, you know, viewing experience ahead of you.
But you'd agree what motivated her on Discovery was the attachment to Burnham, right?
I agree.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
So, with the spinoff.
yes, exactly. You remove that. And then what? I don't know. I would have almost preferred like Georgiou Fortune Hunter show or something.
What's a Fortune Hunter?
I don't know. Wasn't there a show called Fortune Hunter with Tia Carrere?
Oh, okay.
but it's just someone who maybe just travels the galaxy, just out for themselves, taking part in missions and what have you. Kind of like a Mandalorian type show with Georgiou. I think that would fit that character more so than heading an organization.
She's a free agent. We could call it Georgiou : Cleopatra : 2025.
I am sold. I'm more sold on that than I am on Section 31.
Yeah. What about Lorca? His motivations baffled us throughout. He's not really a Starfleet officer. He's in fact a member of the, you know, Terran Empire, a high ranking, you know, commander there. His motivation is he just wants to run the Terran Empire, Cam.
Pretty much. Would you say that Lorca was a good captain?
Okay, it's a weird question, but like, yes, he was, in that he motivated the crew. I just don't know if his own intentions were of that of a good captain, though. But his result, if you're results oriented, I think you could make a very good argument that he was a good captain. He just wasn't a good human being.
Yeah, like that's a thing. And we see that on Star Trek sometimes where, you know, you think of like Jellicoe, for example. Look, it looks horrible to serve on their ships, but they seem to be effective at their jobs. They maybe don't have the people skills that are necessary to be a Picard or a Janeway. But in terms of like a war captain, I think Lorca was pretty good. I don't know. If he were to go to Starfleet Academy and work on the people skills, he might be pretty good.
So Miri Lorca's dead. I'm curious about, you know, Prime Lorca is supposedly dead, but unless we see a body, we don't have to believe it. So I am curious what he's going to be like as a Starfleet officer, if and when we get to see him, I don't know, presumably in Strange New Worlds, if that's a possibility. But I was kind of bummed out that they didn't take that opportunity to bring him back somehow, not Prime Lorca, but Mir Lorca, somehow in the Discovery Season 3 Mirror Universe two-parter.
My sister actually just finished that two-parter, and she was not happy with the fact that they teased Lorca for that much time and then didn't give us even a cameo.
It was stupid. Like, that's why, didn't we joke around like that one-off character in the shuttle, like Dudley or whatever his name was, like maybe that was supposed to be the Lorca role? I don't know.
Yeah, it was a stupid decision, because when you keep floating that to viewers, they're going to expect something at some point.
Yeah. I don't think that character's name was Dudley, but it was something along those lines.
I'm good with Dudley.
Well, it's a great Mirror Universe name, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. What about Cleveland Booker, the alien with a very human name?
I don't even know what to make of this character yet, really. He has superpowers. He's obviously, it's funny. It's almost like they had to get rid of Georgiou to have another character who could be motivated by Michael Burnham to hang out on the ship.
Well, do you know why he's not in Starfleet, Cam?
I don't have a good grasp.
It's because the writers had read the finale script. They knew where everything was going. They knew that by the end of the season, Michael Burnham would be captain, and it'd be very inappropriate if she was pursuing a relationship with, say, an ensign, right? While she was captain. Yeah, like that's
true.
That's the reason he's hanging on the ship, but he's not a Starfleet officer. It's a very weird situation. Does this last until the end of next season as well, where he's just like chilling in his really cool ship that's in the shuttle bay?
I guess they kept Georgiou. Huh. I guess she was only really on the ship for one season, right? Season 3. She's not really on the ship that much in season 2.
She was kind of bouncing on and off. Like she didn't have quarters or anything like that. That's for sure.
No, right. So I could see Book being on the ship maybe throughout the next season, but something has to happen, right?
Like, yeah.
You can't just have your Han Solo character just hanging out without ever, you know, joining the rebellion. He's going to decide to go one way or the other at some point. But you're right. Like, if he joins Starfleet, it's kind of weird if Michael Burnham is the captain. So maybe you transfer him to another ship, but then what? Like, even that gets kind of weird.
Then he's not involved with the show at all anymore.
Yeah.
So,
or at least we're cutting back and forth between the two of them.
Well, yeah. What happens in season 4? I don't know. Hypothetically, what if Book and Michael break up? Does he hang around on Discovery anymore?
I wouldn't think so.
Yeah. So it's a weird position to put this non-Starfleet character in that his role in the ship is... is that why they put him in that navigator situation? And so that Stamets isn't the only navigator for the Spore Drive now?
I guess so, yeah. But, they did leave his shuttle on that ship, so he has an easy exit whenever he needs it.
Yeah, I really want them to give this character a stronger sense of direction so that we know where he's supposed to be going. He just kind of seems like a floater right now.
He does, and so much of his cause early on in season 3 seemed to be about animals. I don't know. Does he still want to do that, or is that over?
You know what? Everybody who's into animals, they'll stay into animals. I don't think that cause is over. I'm sure there'll be more animal storylines. Maybe a triple storyline in season 4.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Cam, Star Trek Picard, the first Star Trek series in which none of the main characters are actually Starfleet officers. And maybe after watching that season 1, there is a reason that Star Trek and Starfleet should be aspirational.
Wait, it wasn't in that show?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we really want to go like character by character. Maybe I'll throw this to you. Is there an obvious character that you can see joining Starfleet, or in the case of Raffi, Rios, and Picard, rejoining Starfleet at any point throughout the show's run?
Boy, when I go down the list, no, there's no one that jumps out to me as someone who would necessarily join. Maybe Soji to follow in the footsteps of Data at some point? That's about it.
Oh, you know, one thing that jumped out to me during my rewatch, though, is that Jurati was actually originally in Starfleet. She said that Maddox had recruited her from Starfleet, and that's why she was at the Daystrom Institute. So she's another character. So even though none of the characters are in Starfleet, more than half of them used to be in Starfleet. It's just Elnor, Soji, and Narek who aren't, or who never were.
Yeah. I've never heard of this Narek character you're talking about, Tyler.
And you never will again.
You see, if you tell me Elnor's going to join by the end, I'm like, sure, I buy it, I guess. Like, Elnor's kind of a vague character at this point. The one question I have is, Starfleet comes across as such a lousy organization throughout Picard season 1. You almost wonder if by the end of the Picard journey, it's about restoring Starfleet to something that maybe like a Rios might go back to.
Yeah. Okay. But then what's what happens to his ship?
Well, that's also a good cause.
It's the main setting of the series. So it's kind of like, I know what you're saying. I think it's logical, but then I'm just like, well, they're not going to do that because it would kind of blow up the entire conceit of the show. where it's like this ragtag Firefly wannabe sort of crew.
Do you think
are we still allowed to like Firefly as of this week, Cam?
I think we're allowed to like Firefly.
Yeah, we're allowed to like Joss Whedon's shows. They're collaborative efforts. Maybe just we don't have to like him personally, right?
I think as, you know, someone who's a fan of film, you have to jump over these hurdles with a very large amount of film stars, some acknowledged publicly as problematic people, very widely, a la Joss Whedon, and some maybe less so, but those who kind of know there's a lot of problems there. So I don't know. It's a struggle I feel everyone has to take on their own, but it's something I've kind of had a certain amount of peace with, I guess.
I think it's telling that we're more interested in talking about the Joss Whedon stuff than we are season one of Star Trek Picard.
Well, yeah. I mean, do you think that this show ends with these people, this ragtag team, still just on the ship going out, hopping around space?
I hope not, because that sounds lame, right? Like, these are all people that are lost. And I wouldn't necessarily say that about other shows in which the entire cast of main characters, they're all people that are ultimately lost. I can say that about the entire cast of this show. I want them to feel found by the end of the series run. I figure the show will probably go maybe 3 seasons. That's my best guess. But if they're just hopping around the galaxy just on the ship still, doesn't it seem weird? Just the legacy of Captain Jean-Luc Picard in Next Generation, he decides to ride out his days with these crew of people that we barely even know and really don't like as much as his original TNG crew.
It's weird, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a bummer.
It is a bummer. There would be something maybe kind of nice if by the end of the show, Soji does join Starfleet and we get a moment where Picard sort of looks at her and you can kind of get that he's seeing sort of the continuation of the data line in Starfleet and we get a little smile or something like that of acknowledgement. I think a moment like that could be nice, but where the show has left me at the end of season one doesn't give me a great sense as to where the show's going, period. Not even in regards to Starfleet. I just mean period.
Well, I am far more excited about the prospects of season two being a show about a ragtag crew going off to different planets, helping people each week. I don't want them to lean as heavily on the serialized aspects. I keep repeating myself, but for Kurtzman era Star Trek, they have it backwards in which their serialized stories are always the A stories. And it's usually more interesting stuff going on in the B stories. It's more episodic stuff. They should have that reversed. It should be the episodic stuff are the A stories, the serialized stuff are the B stories, and then maybe, you know, 2 or 3 times a season they have the quote-unquote mythology episode in which they really tie the serialized ongoing arc into the A story. And I don't have faith that they're going to do that in Star Trek Picard, but if they did what I am saying they should do, I think that there's actually potential for Star Trek Picard to be enjoyable. I didn't hate rewatching season one of Star Trek Picard. I'm more fearful about what our rewatch of season three of Discovery is going to feel like, but I do see there's potential behind both those series going into their respective seasons two and seasons four. I just want them to fix some very obvious flaws that you and I have identified over the last, you know, 6 months or so.
For sure. And I think that's one thing with New Trek, as much as, you know, I can often gripe about certain aspects of its storytelling, is that every season kind of takes us to a new place. So if I don't like one season of it, hopefully next season I like where we are a little more. So there's always that factor. But do you think Elnor goes back to the nunhood?
No, I just like, because he didn't even belong there. Like, that's why they were trying to get rid of him, you know?
Is he hosting the Fellowship of the Ring?
Is he? Well, okay, he would be the obvious Elrond, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. He even looks like him.
He does. Except you can't say he's the Legolas because he doesn't do anything that cool.
Yeah.
although, come to think of it, the show sure seems to like to try to make us think he's the Legolas with his like decapitating people things. So, Maybe.
Until maybe one he's day. Surfboarding down a flight of stairs and shooting arrows at multiple, what are they called? Riemanns? Then I don't care.
Picard season 2, coming to you soon.
Yeah. Okay, so Cam, why don't we wrap this up with Star Trek Lower Decks?
Yeah.
Well, that was great. Star Trek Lower Decks, characters that aren't in Starfleet.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Yeah, well, last month we got to tackle the ideal episode of all time, which of course was Crafting the Perfect Season of Star Trek. And then, Cam, we were inspired, especially by our guest that week. What if we did the worst season of Star Trek? What if we tried to construct just the absolutely worst season imaginable, where it's just a slog to, you know, put that next disc into your Blu-ray player and go for it? I think we're going to have a lot of fun with Scott Hardy once more. I'm really looking forward to this one, Cam. And I think, listeners, it'll be fun to talk about crappy episodes of Star Trek. Let's be honest.
Yeah, although we won't be talking about Return of the Archons.
We won't? Are you sure about that?
I don't know.
I've got episode 18 circled on my list.
From what I've heard, it's one of the best, so.
Better than the Drumhead.
Okay. You can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vorondil the Hunter, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T, T is in Tom Bombadil, O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Now he's back in his home in the land of Shire, that brave little hobbit whom we all admire, just sitting on a treasure of silver and gold, puffing on his pipe in his hobbit hole. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, he's only 3 feet tall. Bilbo, Bilbo Baggins, the bravest little hobbit of them all.
Transfer complete.